Good morning and welcome to Inside Petaluma. I'm Cindy Thomas and I am co-hosting, as always, every Friday from 11 to noon with my friends Janice Cater Thompson and Jason Davies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cindy. I love your beautiful necklace.
You've
never seen that, huh?
Okay, so, well, so the viewers, I'm sure the listeners can see it, but I'm wearing what's called a piece of the stage, and is a peace sign with an inlay of part of the stage from the Woodstock concert.
Oh, man, I want one of those.
Wow, cool. I paid for it, but I wanted it. So.
That's super cool.
I mean, where did you find it?
I mean, I found it online.
You did.
It's certified.
It was definitely a showstopper. It's absolutely beautiful.
How far do they pin that down in terms of the corner of the stage? Is it where Jimi Hendrix was hanging out?
Yes.
Were you there?
No. I'm old enough, but I was not there.
Sorry about that. That's very cool.
Alright, so anyway, happy Friday, everybody.
Yeah, I'm buried in paper right now. Looks like some people are busy sending out information for and against the Measure I.
Yes, and so before we get started on that, I did bring those flyers in for us to look at and talk about, but I'd like to bring our guest on board right up front so he can participate in the discussion. We have today Teddy Herzog, who is a local Petaluma activist. Good morning, Teddy.
Good morning.
We'll talk about some of the other stuff you do later, but
okay.
For now, you're an activist. And happy
Friday. That'll work.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, likewise.
Okay, so the mailers that I got.
Yeah, there's a whole slew of them here. The first one is says Measure I at the top, a $2 billion sales tax increase with no accountability. Of course, that's not entirely true there. Don't give SMART a blank check with our sales tax dollars. No on I. This is from the notsosmart.org. I would agree that they're not so smart. I would definitely agree with that. This is interesting. So people trying to vote against Measure I, they're spending a lot of money on it. I guess both sides are. Here's a response. This is the Great Train Robbery flyer. Pretty nice picture on the front. Shows like an old Western-style robbery going on. And this is about the Gallagher. Is it Gallagher?
Gallagher.
I want to say Gallagher, but that's the guy who threw the watermelons and stuff. The Gallagher family is trying to commit train robbery by taking SMART away from us. Sonoma County tycoon Bill Gallagher and his family are trying to hijack the SMART train and rob us of the green future of transportation in the North Bay. This is interesting. Good marketing on this. So suffice to say, we've got a family for some reason who's spending like upwards almost $1 million, I guess, to try to nix this measure, which is not a new tax. It's just an extension of an existing tax so that we can improve upon the SMART rail, get the stations built, the lines completed, all those good bike paths, all that good stuff. Thoughts on all of this, you guys? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's like BART. If you look back at the beginning of the BART system, I mean, that was difficult to get started, first of all. But when people tell me SMART's a failure, I say, well, just like BART. I mean, it takes some time. It's not like it's going to be an overnight success.
It's only been 2 years.
Well, and I kind of want to play the devil's advocate with the people that are so opposed to it. In 1998, when I was running for city council and I got on the council, I was talking about a northbound on-ramp. So the whole Washington configuration would be changed, so you wouldn't be crossing over traffic, so traffic would flow better. That was in 1998. It was 2013 when that was finally dedicated. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the SMART. It was what year? Was it 2008? I believe we supported SMART. And it was up and going in a short period of time. And people have to look at really how amazing that was, that the general manager got this train up and going in a short period of time. As far as the problem, why they want to extend the tax, is because originally a half a cent sales tax was not viable. People were not going to vote for that. So they would vote for a quarter cent sales tax. So what this does, if you go ahead and extend SMART, it actually saves $12 million because you go ahead and you refund the bonds. And so by refinancing, you're saving $12 million right off the bat.
Exactly.
And so I look at this as how successful to get a train up and going in a short period of time. And it took from 1998 to 2013 to get a northbound on-ramp on Washington.
And there's some numbers. It says over 700,000 passengers a year have been taking SMART. Otherwise would be on in cars or potentially buses, I suppose.
Well, the January numbers went up.
Yeah.
And
I think it's fair to ask about the administration and how's the administration doing. I think, like you said, someone had to come in and kick some butt to get the thing up and running.
That's right.
And it may be that now we're at a point where now that's in operational mode, maybe it's time to change some of that management.
Well, it might be, or we just need to kind of see what direction. I mean, it's really up to the board to make that decision. But I really think that Farhad has done a good job. And, you know, the people that are the biggest complainers, they're only looking in their community. They're not looking at the bigger picture. It's about what's happening to me and me personally and not looking at this as a regional traffic needs to be part of our regional traffic.
I think they did a pretty good job on this flyer. It's got some good bullets here. Only 2 years old, SMART is still very young as a transit service. Year over year, the number of commuters is up 4%. Early indications are that the opening of the Larkspur station connecting to the ferry and the new every half-hour commuter schedule are providing more options and increasing ridership. That's more people avoiding Highway 101 traffic. It goes on further to talk about this. It's not a tax increase. It's simply extending an existing one-quarter cent sales tax. And that guarantees SMART's funding for the next 30 years. SMART will be able to finish the track to Windsor, compete for new regional, state, and federal construction funds to extend the line to Healdsburg and Cloverdale, and continue to qualify for $6 million a year in state money for operations. And this is all about protecting our investments, voting for Measure I. SMART would face uncertain future without it. There is no transit agency in the world that operates without continued funding for operations. Measure I would protect our investment in the future of transportation in North Bay. It would allow SMART to continue operating as well as restructure construction debt and save $12.2 million annually to fully fund operations for the entire line for the next 30 years.
I like to talk about SMART as an economic development corridor.
Yeah,
right now, you've got a bunch of track laid.
Yeah.
You've got a number of stations built. There's more track to be laid, more stations. But what's the key to this is the land uses that will be built in the future, and none of those have been built yet. I mean, you're going to need new housing where a person can walk out and jump on the train and go to a job that's also on the train track line. And so the land use development that will occur over the next 10 to 20 years is what creates this as an economic development corridor.
And that's why when you look at something, you have to project out. You can't just look at today or complain about yesterday. You need to move forward. And it really is a 20-year vision.
Yep.
And that's what's going to happen because right now people are coming up from Marin County, getting on the train, stopping in Petaluma more so than the other stops. And so that's good for the economics of our community. And once the housing is built, you're going to just see so much more. The town is going to be vibrant.
This is a riot, this one. They're flying high in their jet. While the Gallagher family flies high in their jet, they want us to sit in traffic down below. It shows one of their private jets. Sonoma County tycoon Bill Gallagher and his family fly around in their private jet, so traffic isn't a problem for them.
Exactly.
For the rest of us, we're sitting in traffic on Highway 101. We're taking the SMART train.
You know, I haven't seen those, but last night I was actually in Santa Rosa phoning for Measure I. Yep. And so Marin County is where phoning. And I only talked to one person, but otherwise I left a lot of messages. So if people really want this to pass, you know, and if you're interested in doing phone banking, let me know.
Did you get more than these? Because what I'm noticing is there's only one flyer against, and these three
those all came this week.
Wow.
Huh.
You mentioned the big chunk of money that's for the No on I campaign. Yeah. I believe someone stepped forward with a big chunk of money.
He did. Grayton did.
And there's other money coming in also.
For some reason.
Grayton?
It just sounds cool.
It sounds like something
fancy.
Yeah. Now, the current measure that we're being taxed on, which was, what year was that?
I want to say 2008. I don't know why.
It doesn't expire for a few more years.
Right.
But the thing is that when we're talking about the reason you want to get in before that you're getting close to the extension, it's the same with the fairgrounds.
Right.
You can't bond
right.
if you don't have something to bond
exactly.
from.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so you get favorable financing today based on that
right.
future.
That's exactly
that,
right.
right.
Yeah.
What
right.
I was going to say is if this should by chance fail, we still have a chance to...
You can put it on in 2 years,
but what's
interesting is they're trying to extend the Measure M, the 101 widening tax. And what that is about, it's interesting. I'm reading in the newspaper John Burns and Kathy Miller what they're saying about this, and they're saying, oh, yeah, that's going to be about streets. It is absolutely not about the street in front of your house.
Right.
It's only about big infrastructure. Right off the bat, the Argus Courier is doing yellow journalism, lying about what a tax measure is, and that's what concerns me. If this one doesn't pass, they're going to push the other one, and I don't think Kathy Miller on our city council is going to care about SMART because she hasn't really pushed it, where the council should be saying why they think that this is really important for the economics of our community.
Right.
So right.
It's also important for us that live on the east side. I would train into town. I live on the northeast side.
That's interesting to see who would do that. Let's get across
town
on the train.
I absolutely would.
Yep.
There's no parking. I would spend less time walking to the station, getting on a train downtown than I would looking for parking.
Well, I just want to go back to this Measure M because last week we were at the Corona station and there was a group of senior citizens, moms, and just residents. 31 people met, and Cindy was there, Jason was there, all four of us were there.
Right.
And what we did is we walked up to Beyond the Glory because Kathy Miller said, oh, well, people can get off the train and just walk to Beyond the Glory.
Or Safeway.
Or Safeway, yeah, with no sidewalks. And this goes back to the Measure M. There is, she's saying, oh, you're going to get sidewalks. You're going to get your street in front of your house fixed. And that is not true.
Mm.
There's no money in here for really sidewalks. 80% or 90% is major road projects, which is why the Gallaghers probably would want this because they're going to go ahead and get the streets and roads done for development. The public is going to pay for that, and they'll probably reduce impact fees because we don't need those anymore for transportation because the public is now paying for it, and they want to do Measure M in perpetuity.
Hmm.
And so it goes back to what we did last week, that walk. Realizing that there's no sidewalks, how dangerous it was, and yet the council member is not telling the truth about what Measure M is going to pay for.
I'm a huge proponent for pedestrian-oriented lifestyle, and actually I do walk around town quite a bit, and I'll go to the south, down to the marina, I'll go west, but I'll also go east occasionally because I'm interested in Brody Ranch, I'm interested in the new train station project. And it's really not very comfortable. I mean, when I'm walking over there, I've got my noise-canceling headphones on, and it's still very intense walking up North McDowell. And it's not a quality life. It's a poor quality lifestyle, and it doesn't lead to community. Everybody's in their car racing around, and it's very intense.
Do you use Washington or the Lynch Creek Trail?
Lynch Creek Trail, yeah. I try to stay off the road to the extent I can. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that McDowell is just becoming a major truck route to the post office getting off at Washington Street. The city management could contact the Postal Service and say, hey, we want you to stay on 101, get off at Old Redwood Highway. But they're not doing that. And sometimes I think they're not doing that is because they want to make traffic so bad that they're going to promote it. And yet they could be doing something, because I've talked to the city manager more than once about those trucks, because I personally contacted Lagunitas because they were doing the same thing. Lagunitas stopped getting off at Washington Street. And so that's why I know it can happen.
Right.
But a citizen shouldn't have to do that. And our council doesn't have a clue of what's going on. And that's one reason why I kind of am a supporter of district elections. I'd like to have some representation, and I don't.
Well, that's why we did that walk last weekend, is because unless you walk it yourself, you can't figure out what's really going on.
Exactly.
That was pretty scary, walking on
that.
Well, we had to have a police escort, didn't we?
Yeah. I mean, we all had our yellow vests. I mean, especially if you're there by yourself. It's
right.
It's risky.
You know, it's like Teddy and I were talking, 35,000 people use the health district a year. Mm-hmm. And that is could be within walking distance from the train station or the post office. The senior citizens in the mobile home parks, they would be walking up there. But it's just, there's no sidewalks.
Yeah.
On a four-lane.
There's a bus stop right in front and no sidewalk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to say that I appreciate the way that I met you was kind of on Facebook. How I met Teddy was on Facebook. I'm thinking, who is this guy? It's, you know, it's interesting. He's in West Sider, but he's really connected to the whole town or looking at the whole picture. And I met you a year ago at the Corona Forum for the Corona Station.
That's, right.
That's where we met.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I had no idea what he even looked like. And then all of a sudden he said his name, and then I went introduced myself. And what I'm impressed with, you've been here for 7 years?
5 years.
5 years. Yeah. You are really connecting yourself within the community, and you're thinking. You're a thinker.
Well, I like to say my expertise is in my feet, literally, because I've walked this town in all directions.
Yeah.
And I've also walked a lot of other cities in Europe, even around the country. My daughter's now going to school in Chicago, and that place is fun to walk around.
Yeah.
In Evanston, where Northwestern is.
Yeah.
It's fun to see a town that's got a very highly developed transit system,
right.
Bicycles, pedestrians.
Yeah.
And not only could we have that, I mean, we need to have that here because the East Side has gotten so carried away with being a strictly automobile dependent land use that now's the time where we say, okay, we've got enough cars driving around. What can we do to slowly build in a pedestrian lifestyle that's going to make a higher quality of life instead of a continually worse, more intense lifestyle?
What you see on the East Side is more people are actually walking. And since when the Deer Creek Center was built, some of us really wanted that to be more of a pedestrian site.
Yeah.
And we wanted it mixed use. And they went the other direction, and now they're trying to make it a mixed use. But people actually, you see people walking there all the time because of the dog park.
You're right.
And because of the gym. And so you need to build a sense of community. It's not being against development. It's being about what you can build so it's a sense of community. And I really do see a difference because of that dog park.
If you've got a community where people are driving in and out of their garages, and every trip everywhere is a car trip, and you get a different sense of community than if people are walking out, let's walk down to the corner store, let's walk to the coffee shop.
Right.
That builds community, and it builds a whole different experience.
It is. Absolutely.
So you've done some interesting things, including hiking to the bottom of Mount Everest.
I have. I like to say I'm a rock climber and a mountaineer. I haven't done a whole lot of rock climbing lately, but every year I still get out to the Eastern Sierras. And I did manage to get a trip into Nepal once, and I did the traditional trek that Sir Edmund Hillary did, what was that, 1957?
Wow.
Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, and in that May was the 50-year anniversary of that trip, and then I went and did it in November, and so I did the whole exact walk they did all the way to the base of Mount Everest. Of course, they kept going and climbed to the top. I didn't do all that.
So when you're at the base, do you still have to have oxygen, or is it not that?
No, you don't, but you definitely feel the elevation. It's 19,000 feet.
Oh, it is.
By far, that's the highest I've ever been. The highest elevation in the United States is 14,500, and there it was at 19,000 feet. And if you wanted to go to the top of Everest, that's 29,000 feet, so that's another 10. So you really are nowhere once you've gotten to the bottom of Everest.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about Jerry Price, a resident of our community. Jerry's definitely, he's in his 80s, but he did Everest. He didn't make it to the top. He ended up getting sickness,
altitude
sickness.
Yeah,
and they had to, I think, carry him down. But I'm hoping to connect you two to talk about
it. Yeah, I'd like to meet him. That'd
be
great.
Because he has a fabulous slideshow of it.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's very difficult to get there. It's a tourist.
Right.
There's literally lines of people waiting to go to the top of the summit every day because the season's a fairly narrow window. I believe May is the best time to do it.
And you had some people, I think, dying recently.
People die pretty regularly.
Yeah.
But you were in, for 9 months, you were living in Guatemala. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, at the end of my life, that's probably going to be one of my most favorite memories. I have a friend, David Hammond, who started a nonprofit organization called AlterTech. which is about working with small Highland farmers and giving them alternatives to chemical pesticides and chemical fertilizers. And he said, hey, come on down and check it out. And I did. I went down there for 9 months, and I helped him build a model farm with my construction experience. I got to travel around a lot. I learned enough Spanish to where I can travel, and nice. I can actually build a house speaking Spanish. That's my a huge, important memory for me and a formative part of my life, where living around these indigenous people have been there for thousands of years,
yeah.
and the social injustice that's been imposed upon them, pushed further and further in the highlands, away from the fertile lowlands, which was all snapped up by people with money and
mm-hmm.
people who were not the native indigenous folks. I learned so much. And as I tell people, if you can go on a trip like that, when you come back to a different country because you come back as a different person. You're not the same person anymore.
It's very true.
Well, yeah, and we've done our share of that here in terms of wiping out indigenous cultures and
we have.
Taking their properties.
It's one of...
I'm really concerned about what's going to happen in the 2020 election.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of DACA students, and, you know, we need to remember that they are here, and that if Trump gets reelected, he will go after anybody to get them out of this country who's not white. And it's interesting, you know, when you go to another country, you really see the injustice, and then we're seeing the same thing in our country, and it's pretty frightening.
But going back to the idea of the coastal Miwok, there's almost no indication that there was ever a coastal Miwok here, except for the mural that's painted at the intersection of Washington and Petaluma Boulevard.
Right. Well, in Point Reyes, you can see.
That's true. There's,
I mean, but I don't know if that's, is it an actual village or it's a simulated?
It's a simulated village, one. I mean, I don't know how we could do it. I know the library that is starting to put together an exhibit. For them, and I would like to see something more because it is such an important part of who we are. I mean, it's not necessarily us genetically, but it's the we stepped into a land and a time and a culture and then built the current version of Petaluma out of that.
We had Mrs. Murphy that lived down the street from us, and I was raised on Eli Road on a ranch, and she had a collection of Indian arrowheads and mortar and pestle, all from Lynch Creek. And all from these properties. She just walked and she picked these up. And she ended up moving actually to Murphy's, California. And I was too young to realize I really needed to find a way to get that back to Sonoma County because it's historical.
It is historical.
And I remember, you know, being in the barn, you know, her barn in the old house, and she would show me this display. And it just, it's unfortunate. That I wasn't old enough to know.
You never got it back? You never found her?
Well, she died. I mean, you know, she ended up dying. And my parents had bought that one chunk of property from her. And, you know, so she's gone.
I think it's important to understand the lineage that you came from. And if we can somehow begin to learn more about the coastal Miwoks and somehow make that a part of the cultural exhibits or cultural awareness in our community, it would be... spiritually enriching, for lack of a better phrase.
When we were doing the wastewater plant for Ellis Creek, it was, you know, an environmental project is what we were looking for. The polishing ponds are shaped actually like the salt harvest mouse, and people don't realize this when you're walking up there. But Patricia Johansson, who was an environmental artist that did the main drawings for this, all by hand, she, you know, wasn't using a computer. It's the old way of drawing. Everything was written onto the side. And she really researched the Miwok Indians because you wanted to have that as part of the project so you really understood the long history. But because of politics, that part really didn't wasn't formulated with the community or the city because the city didn't look at the value of the art and they didn't look at the value of the history. And that's what Petaluma does a lot. And there, we can still get it back.
We can still do that.
We can still do it.
And hopefully we are.
And but there's a lot of resources out there that we can use. And I appreciate that you're bringing this up.
We've spent a lot of time remembering Vallejo, but there's a lot of history that came before that.
Yeah,
and that's right.
And it really helps us understand the land. That, I mean, Petaluma is here for a topographical, geographic reason. It's the river.
That's right.
And other people before us figured that out. And it would be it's useful to understand how things have changed over time. Like when people talk about, well, there's too many people coming to Petaluma, there's too much traffic. I always think about, well, tell that to, what's her name, Soupy, the last Miwok woman. There's an article
about
Soupy, the last. I mean, I'm sure she had similar thoughts when she walked away in 1880 or whenever that was.
Yeah, and you know, personally, I welcome the new people coming in. You know, I appreciate that you moved to Petaluma, and there's a lot of new people. I mean, Jason, I mean.
Well, I'm not new anymore.
Well, you're not new anymore. Older people that have been here a long time would consider you guys still newbies. And you're really not. You're actually bringing a lot to the community. And that's much appreciated.
Well, that's very nice of you, Janice.
Oh, it's true, Jason.
I'm curious about your book, Warrior Uprising, The Guide to Self-Mastery, First Edition. This was something published in 2017.
Yeah, I was living in San Francisco for 17 years. I was remodeling old houses. I was in a marriage, and her family was supporting us to go out and buy houses and fix them up and flip them. We acquired some apartments. And then in 2004, I had what I would call like a, well, the very beginning of a spiritual and an emotional awakening, and that led to a divorce, and I actually ended up in a small town in Colorado called Pagosa Springs. And it was a long journey of me shedding layers. Actually, I told you this a little bit before the show. Is very much, growing up, I wanted to learn how to become a man, and I identified with the Clint Eastwood cowboy character.
Mm-hmm.
And that persona is part of...
Not the Dirty Harry.
Just not the Dirty Harry, no. It's
the cowboy.
The cowboy, like the lone gunslinger, self-reliant, never shows any emotion. And that's part of, I mean, my dad was that way too. Very stoic, hardly ever said anything unless he was yelling because he had his own inability to communicate. And so I was very shut down, very quiet, and emotionally dead. Mm-hmm. And I would refer to myself prior to 2004 as Dead Ted, and that's a fair characterization. I think a lot of men grow up that way. The way you learn to become a man is shut down your feelings, shut down your emotions, shut down your heart, and just be tough and stoic and smart and compete. And so this book is, in a way, a culmination of what I learned from 2004 until I published the book in 2017. It talks a lot about my own journey of awakening and what I learned in terms of freeing myself up, unwinding myself from the puppet strings of my behaviors. We all grow up learning how we're supposed to act from our parents and from the culture. And most of the choices we make most of the time are not choices of free will, but they're actually embedded patterns of behavior that most of us learn from our parents. And if you can begin seeing the automaticity with which I began seeing the automaticity with which I was acting in the world, and then do the work to kind of unwind from that. It's like, where did I learn this behavior of being stoic, and where did I learn to be tough and gruff and mean and not talk to anybody and feeling like I have to compete and win and be more successful and more successful no matter what? That as a man, my identity was dependent upon me being successful in a business way, but not necessarily being successful in connecting with people in a heartfelt way. Hmm. So that's, I've just said a lot of things, but if I was to boil it down to what's the difference between Dead Ted and the guy Teddy, who's much more heart-centered, it's that I have much more of an ability to connect on a personal level with people in a way that I did not allow myself. I was afraid of people, and I was afraid to be vulnerable, but I'm much more willing to do that now.
This, I believe, is a quote from your book. It says, opening up fully to the world seems to be scary. It's certainly not how I learned to be a man as a young teenager. As a young warrior, I learned to be uptight, constricted, and emotionally shut down. Opening up to each moment fully is the practice of the mature warrior.
Yeah, I learned that from my dad. That's the way my dad learned how to be a man. He was German in New York around World War II and got beat up as a kid for being German. And his father actually ran off from the marriage and went back to Germany to join the great fights. And so my dad, from the age of 8 on, grew up without a father figure. And so he, in a similar way that I described about myself, he just learned, well, I'm going to be tough and strong. And he was 6'4", 280 pounds of muscle and a bricklayer. And he didn't talk much. He certainly had very little ability to connect with his emotions. And so I mimicked him in that way. And that's how I learned to be a man. And I mention all this because it's not just me. I think a lot of men have the same kind of story.
This is another quote. There are only two paths to take in life at any moment, opening yourself up or closing yourself down. For me, closing down is a kind of steeling myself for battle. It's the suit of armor that I taught myself to wear long ago. Yeah.
I think that's key. Is in an earlier version of me wanted to be safe and protected, and that safe and protected version is a dying and a dead person. But there's an ability to open up, and if you begin to open up enough, if you can open up, let go of the fear and the concern and the unwillingness to be vulnerable, you can actually be so open that nothing can harm you. It's like I have a picture of water running off the back of a duck for some reason. It's if you're willing to be so vulnerable and so open and so authentic, there's nothing that can really harm you. I don't say it like someone, I've arrived there. I hold that out as a goalpost myself ahead of me.
Was there something that happened that led you to this specifically, or was this something over time you started to figure out? Or
well, the marriage disintegrated in 2004, and I was actually glad to be getting out of that marriage, and I knew I was going to be dating. And I knew I needed to do some work on myself before I could start dating. And that was kind of the entry onto that path.
So did you do this on your own, or did you seek help?
I did a series of workshops. I'd say the number one workshop I've done is a Hoffman process, which is a week-long workshop that's held in St. Helena.
Okay.
I've done a number of other workshops. I took a six-month life coaching program with Heather Steele in Denver. And that was very intensive because for 6 months, actually, the person I was coaching and working on was myself. And so I did a lot of deep work there. And I could go on and on. There's lots of other workshops out there. I've read a lot of different books. And I've spent time with other people doing on that journey as well.
So then you went on to be an integrative, holistic coach yourself.
I did, yeah. And that's not something I actively do, but I bring that. For example, when I participating with the community in the issues that I'm passionate about, which for me the two issues I'm passionate about with Petaluma are pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods and the train, I kind of look and see, well, what's the psychological sea that everyone is swimming in? And I think I have compassion. I don't. For me, I don't look at the city council and say, well, the city council should be doing this or should be doing that. I look at all together, we all kind of live in this psychic space. I had a lot of fun actually watching Marianne Williamson on her little run for the presidency, and she would talk about the psychic, which is the psychic something. And I thought it was very interesting because she was spot on. It's like, we don't all just think for ourselves and come up with our own ideas. We actually live in a sea of thought, and we're not all doing our own thinking. We're actually part of, and Einstein said this. Einstein said, I didn't just come up with E equals MC squared by myself. He was able to tap into a higher intelligence, and we're all part of that higher intelligence. And so I'm talking about a lot of different things, but when I'm interested in, well, how can we make the community better? For me, it's not interesting to figure out who's to blame and who's to fault. It's I like to see how am I responsible and how are us, the people in the room, responsible, and what can I do personally to make the community a better place? I kind of went on and on. Did anything I say make sense?
It all makes sense to some people, I'm sure.
Okay, good. So I'm checking back in with you.
No. I mean, a number of things that you said make a lot of sense. You know, one thing about trying to find a solution and being part of the solution as opposed to just criticizing people that are involved in making decisions. I think that's a good point.
And some people will hate that I've said this, but the day after Trump got elected, I said, he's the perfect representative of us, whether you like it or not. Somehow he represents the American psyche.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
that's my own way of thinking. But
well, I would say that he certainly reflects the people that supported him.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
There's something very American about him.
But fortunately, it's a minority of the population.
Well, we hope it is.
Well, and if you even look at who actually voted, I mean, most people didn't.
Well, most people didn't. Look at who did not vote.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean.
60-something percent didn't vote.
Yeah,
so people have to vote.
Well, people have to vote. Yeah. They have to be engaged. They have to want to have an impact.
So have you thought about getting involved in, you are kind of involved in the community, of course, but have you thought about getting involved in local politics directly yourself?
I mean, the two things I'm interested in is helping people figure out how the system works and what I or you could do about it. And I've made a few videos about that. I think that's what really interests me is, can I help people understand how the system, the city council, the land use planning system works, and what each of us can personally do to contribute to it. I mean, the idea of being on city council, I mean, honestly, I can see it's a pretty thankless job. I mean, like if I was to run for city council and be elected, it's like, well, okay, now I'm the next person. It's all your fault.
Well, there's also committees and commissions. You know, you're
very
much
consuming.
Oriented towards pedestrians and imagine bicycles. There's a committee.
I could see being on the planning commission someday in the near future.
Yeah. So you have a background in land use.
I was a career land use planner with the County of San Mateo and also worked on the transportation plan for a year. So that's my background as a general contractor. I've participated in the system pulling permits from various jurisdictions. So I have a land use planning background and a general understanding of how that works.
Well, I'll just ask you, how do you think it's working in Petaluma? Mm-hmm. I mean, we had Sid Commons the other day, and one thing is, you know, what I know is that there are a lot of documents out there, reports, and a lot of the reports talk about flooding, what's going to happen with flooding, and specifically the Corps of Engineers project. They specifically said the more upstream development, the more downstream flooding, and that was also in the 101 EIR. The more, you know, because we're adding an extra lane, and with what the city of Petaluma is proposing, if they build more upstream, you're going to degrade the flood control project. Mm-hmm. And what's going to end up happening is that the Peyran area, which was protected by the flood control project, they are now being asked again to buy flood control insurance, flood insurance.
Yeah.
And if the city is saying you guys need to buy flood insurance and the council is continuing to build in areas that will contribute to flooding, how do you deal with the council? Somebody coming in,
turn it back on myself. Yeah. I'm going to turn it back to us as a people. I think most of us still have this dream of the single-family house with the white picket fence.
Right.
Like, yeah, right. Oh, someday I'm going to have the picket fence in a nice little house, and we're almost at the end of it. I mean, how many more single-family houses with white picket fences can we build in Petaluma? Is it 1,000? Probably it's not more than 2,000, right? And so we're transitioning now, but there's still this great inertia and momentum towards we'll just keep building like we did. We'll just build more single-family houses, and the way you get back and forth from the house is in the automobile. Yeah. And as much as we start talking about some of these other ideas, the unconscious momentum is, we'll just build some more. And so a developer walks through the door and says, I'd like to plunk down 110 single-family houses at the new Corona train station. It just unconsciously makes sense that, yes, we'll stamp that approved and move on.
Well, I have a hard time with it because, you know, I've been watching it for so long and, you know, seeing what's going on. And I think it's really important that the council members need to be called out on what they're doing because, you know, in 40 years, because what they're doing is, what the city council is doing, and I want to go back to the dredging. I feel as though the dredging, what they're really trying to do is, they're trying to say it's about economics and it's about bringing boats in, but they're trying to create a flood control project so they can build upstream, and then they can go ahead and dredge downstream. So what the city is trying to do is find a mechanism to charge the public for dredging, because they're building upstream, right, going to cause a problem downstream, right, and now they're asking you and I to add fees on to our wastewater or our water, and under the name auspice of flooding.
Yeah.
And it is just wrong, and I do believe council members need to be called out on this, because there's a lot of people that just can't afford fees going up. And for the reason of creating flooding downstream, so they're protecting property owners upstream that will create downstream flooding. This is a fact. All the documents say it. And what I find city staff is doing, they're young. They've never been involved in a flood. They don't really know about hydrology, in my opinion. At the meeting the other night when on Sid Common, I was there and I decided to go home because I could tell it was going to be a late night and probably what the vote was. So I went home and I was listening to the meeting and I was hearing the hydrologist that works for the city of Petaluma, and the hydrologist was kind of saying, well, I guess it's going to work. I mean, there wasn't a real solid that it was going to work. And then I heard John Chaney's voice, and John Chaney's been flooded out many times. I got my rear end out of bed, went down to that meeting because I was listening to institutional knowledge that I have institutional knowledge that they don't. And what bothers me is you have a council member, Mike Healy's been on there for 20 years. He knows this. And he, as a lawyer, is manipulating the words like Mitch McConnell does. And it's going to flood downstream. And so I'm a little bit more intense than, you know, your approach or other people's approach. But I'm tired of yellow journalism. Well, I'm tired of the newspaper following this. And the public ends up being screwed.
I mean, what I'm tired of is ignoring planning commissions.
Exactly.
Because we have a planning commission with experts on these topics. One in particular is actually an expert in hydrology.
That's right.
And I don't see the point in having a planning commission if you continue to just ignore their recommendations.
Or this is a second appeal process.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, how unmotivating that must be for someone who's a planning commissioner to spend so much time on a topic, make your recommendations, and then have, you know, four people on the council just completely ignore it. I just don't get it.
Well, that's part of that inertia, that momentum. It's like the planning commission is a more forward-thinking body. The city council, institutionally, still building from the old way.
I'm thoroughly convinced we need some changes on the city council.
No, we absolutely do.
I think we need some changes in campaign financing.
Yeah,
well,
that too.
I think we also need an awareness from the public. It's how many more single-family houses do we need? I mean, who benefits in town from more single-family houses being built? I don't see a benefit to anyone anymore. We need to think of, what's the city need to be like in 20 years? In my way of thinking, we need pedestrian-oriented housing. All the new housing should be higher-density housing near the two train stations, for example.
Well,
that's kind of my
one thing with the conversation about the corona, which kind of floored me. I'm listening to a council member saying, well, these are apartments because we really want higher density at a rail station. And so by doing higher density, I really like what Jenny Griffo was proposing.
Yes.
And, you know, you have one bedroom, two bedrooms, instead of these single family, three bedrooms. And then a council member is saying, well, they are like apartments. People are going to be buying them and renting out rooms. And then another member of the council is saying, oh, yeah, and all the garages are going to be converted into
ADUs.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm thinking, these are the progressives we think on the council that are saying this. And that doesn't make any sense because the parking ratio doesn't fit.
Right.
And the access in and out of the project doesn't make any sense. There's no trees. There's no pocket parks. And there's
nowhere to walk to.
Nowhere to walk to. And they're presenting this as like a family-oriented development of single-family homes. And the paradigm is that the thought process has got to change, but it's really hard because the public isn't affected by that property at this point because they don't really know what's going on there.
No.
It's really up to members of the public to do YouTube to try and get the message out, but they have a solid 4-5 vote on development.
It's the public that needs to be educated on what's the future. If we continue in the direction we're headed, where are we going to end up? Is this going to be much more automobiles?
Right.
And so we need to change the ship now, and that ship changing is let's start focusing on pedestrian-oriented housing. And what that means is, can you get walk out of your house and get around town or get around the Bay Area without jumping into your car?
Well, and that goes back to what we did last weekend. 31 people took a walk on a roadway that should have sidewalks. And what did Councilmember Healy say? He said, oh, you know, well, you're going to have to talk to the property owners about that. So they take no responsibility, and they're doing 1962 thinking, and they're not even focusing on extending a road tax. They're only looking at a road tax. They're not looking at the importance of sidewalks, because that is where mobility comes. And people don't see it unless they're affected by it.
Well, we need a future-thinking land use for the East Petaluma. We can't just build monocrop of single-family houses. If you're going to build 100, even if you're only going to build those 110 houses at the Corona train station, it has to have a little grocery store, a little corner store, and a coffee shop. So not only does that new community have a place to walk to, but the seniors across the street have a place to walk to. I don't know how many houses are within a half a mile to the east, but it's quite a few. I mean, there's
I can
a large,
walk there.
Yeah, I can walk by there.
There's a large population.
Yeah.
A big population.
So we need to start building mixed use on a parcel that's zoned mixed use, and not say, well, we're going to zone it for single-family houses. So.
Well, I think what's really good is there are people reaching out to the seniors, and they're starting to wake up.
Yep.
Because they're kind of stuck in their own little island.
It's
and
like
now
how much worse can it get?
Exactly.
It's like boiling frogs in water.
Exactly.
It really is.
And they're doing the same development project right across the street, and the city can't even contact the post office and say, we want you to change the route and get off at Old Redwood Highway. So they're not considerate of the community. They're considerate of the developer only. And I was really hoping staff was going to have a turnaround with our new city manager. And I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing it's development as usual. And she can count. There's 4 votes there. And just like Mitch McConnell can count.
Well, I guess this last one was 5 votes.
Well, it was. It was 5-4. It was not a 4-3.
5-2.
No, exactly. Yeah. It was exactly.
Well, I did live in San Francisco for 17 years, and I can tell you things have turned around dramatically in San Francisco.
Yes, they
But
have.
First, it had to get worse, and San Francisco had to get to the point of maximum automobile. Virtually the entire time that I lived there, we were at maximum automobile, and on Friday afternoons, the radical bicyclists would take to the streets
in the rush hour.
Yeah. And there was no bicycle infrastructure at all
in
2003, 2004.
And they're looking at closing Market Street altogether.
Yeah, and now it's one of the most bicycle-friendly cities in the country.
It's amazing.
And so, unfortunately, things probably have to get worse car-wise in Petaluma before the thinking shifts amongst the public.
Unfortunately,
so you talk about voting in other city council members. I'll again say it's up to me. It's up to us. We got to change our thinking. It's like
they've got the power.
The public,
you might think that that's the way it goes. It's up to us. They have the power and they have the votes, and that's all that matters.
Someone's electing.
Well, the thing is, the people that are electing these people, most of them favor transit-oriented development. Most of them are aware of the issues with climate change. Most of them are aware that this is a centerpiece of our city's goal is to tackle climate change and promote developments that aren't helping to push for more car use. It's not the people. People are being tricked.
That's right.
They're told by
the council members, by the newspapers,
that supporting these candidates and supporting their policies is going to alleviate the very problems they're creating. And I think that's the problem, is there's people are aware of the issues, people are on the right side of the issues, but somehow there's a disconnect when it comes to voting because the propaganda is so good.
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room is Rainier.
Yeah.
And this is what they're going to tell people. Yeah. If you don't vote for Measure M and extend it, you will never get Rainier or you'll never get Caulfield.
Yeah.
But what you're not going to get is the street in front of your house ever repaved
right.
or sidewalks so you can walk. And it's really important to let people understand that. And once you start getting the mobile home park, you know, the seniors there to understand this, they will activate.
Right.
And they're just finally understanding it because now it's hitting their backyard. They've been living on an island and they really didn't realize it.
Well, people have been told for 50 or 60 years that Rainier was a solution.
Right.
Where is it? People don't necessarily know that it's an $88 million solution and it's not going to happen because there's not that kind of money.
Well,
around.
If Measure M goes, that is on the list, and that is the only thing that's really going to ever get done. And the street and in front of your house will never get repaved because they're only depending on the gas tax. And, I mean, I'm right now doing a Public Record Act request for the Corona Overcrossing because I want to know what was it really retrofitted in 1995? Because there's no indication of that.
No.
I can't get those documents from the city. I can't get those documents from our supervisor. I have to go to Caltrans and jump through hoops.
No.
Our council members should want to see those documents. Not one of the seven is asking. So they're making the public go through hoops. So I'm really concerned about if it's not what you care about, we're just going to ignore it. And I think transportation is important.
Yeah.
An overcrossing built in 1956. And in case of an earthquake, it's all part of the system. And it's about walkability. Because what we didn't really do is, as a group, walk over the Corona Overcrossing last weekend.
Yeah.
Because there is Lombardi's on the other side. There's Industrial Drive. We have river walkways now being connected.
Yeah.
And eventually it'll be from downtown all the way up north. That's why that overcrossing is probably the most important to upgrade because there's no pedestrians or bicycle lanes.
Right.
And the railings are so low in Santa Rosa, they've put barriers so people can't fall onto the freeway.
Right, exactly.
So
there's people living on the west side on the other side of Corona
yeah.
that could bicycle over to the train station.
And those people,
that's right.
But those were the people, and some of them are the climate change people
mm-hmm.
that said, oh, no, when I bought my land on Steelman Lane, I made sure that Corona wasn't going to be upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, and then you go to the front of the city council and talk about climate change,
mm-hmm.
every group has hypocrites.
mm-hmm.
So,
well,
that's my say.
Well, yeah, and I think it's tough, back to the council members, when they run on something and you believe that's what they actually stand
yeah.
for, then they vote the opposite. I mean, we have a current council
yeah.
member who I supported, and I'm not happy with his recent vote because it flies in the face of what I thought he was running on beforehand. So sometimes you make choices that don't turn out.
And it doesn't help that developers are stuffing money in their pockets every campaign
right.
season.
Right.
I mean, that's a big thing right there.
Yeah.
David Keller has always said they dance with the one who brung them.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's how I see it. We need more pain of more traffic first before people realize what we're doing is not working anymore.
They've bought into the Rainier so badly.
Yep.
They're bringing back the potholes that they did in 2002 to get myself off the council.
Mm.
So that was a political hit piece also. 20 years later, Mike's still on the council. The potholes aren't done. And they're going to continue supporting his 1962 development and yellow journalism. Because the newspaper... That's who the newspaper listens to.
Maybe it would help if oil companies did a bunch of flyers supporting their candidacies.
They just might.
That didn't work well for the person who's getting us.
I'll be really clear. I mean, the amount of time this council put on the Safeway gas station. They put more time on that versus any of these other projects. And yet you're seeing traffic increase. People are pissed off. And they just put hundreds of hours into one project because one person hated the property owner and the other person, it was a backdoor deal. That's all I can say. And it's being funded by another petroleum company. No gas here.
Well,
I'm going to end it there.
Yeah, I was going to say, as usual, we could go on and on for hours.
Yeah, we could.
Yes, and we'll do it another time.
I'm so glad you're here, though.
Thank
yes.
you. Thanks
yes,
for inviting
we,
me.
We have Teddy Herzog here with us today, and thank you very much for being here, and hopefully you will come back.
I will.
Yes, we have lots to talk about. And you've been listening to Inside Petaluma. I'm Cindy Thomas, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Janice Cater-Thompson and Jason Davies, and we're heading into another weekend.
Have a great
weekend. Well, I want to thank Cindy for all that she does, because she really pulls us together with the board and trying to keep her and us together, and I really appreciate
that.
Well,
you did that. I saw that.
It's not easy.
My people that listen, that they always say to me, how come you never talk very much? My wife, well, for one thing, Janice and Jason never let me talk. And for the other thing, I'm so busy keeping an eye on all the electronics here. The technical part.
She's our director.
Competitive sport.
Yeah. But
exactly.
Anyway, I also handle our Facebook page, which is KPCA Inside Petaluma. Go there and like us. And you can also check there every week to see who our upcoming guest is. And we also have a website, InsidePetaluma.com, which Jason is our technician. And he will connect this show and every show that we've had into the archives of Inside Petaluma.
Yes, I'm behind on the last one. I'll be there.
Anyway, it's been our pleasure, and we will see you again next Friday. I almost got confused with one of those shows. See you on Friday, 11 to noon, right here on KPCA 103.3 FM and KPCA.fm, streaming live. We'll see you guys later.
See you.
WCCA 103.3 FM. Brown Boy Talking, your weekly news and talk show, will be on in just a few minutes, so please stay tuned.